Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Today's study explores the Torah reading Devarim, covering Deuteronomy chapter 1 through chapter 3, verse 22. It also touches on parallel passages in Isaiah chapter 1, verses 1 through 27, Acts chapter 7, verse 51 through chapter 8, verse 4, and Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. We'll see how lack of trust in heaven as deliverer required Israel and requires us today to be born again before reaching the destination. It's where we're needed for the rescue mission of all humanity through Messiah Yeshua.
This recounting that Moshe is doing to the second generation, born again Israel, as they enter into the land, that you're seeing this roller coaster ride of belief from where they started, being called out as a people, starting with Abraham being called out to Mesopotamia, to the land, and then recounting how they were then called out of Mitzrayim, the house of bondage, and then their journeys through and talking about how the first generation had trust issues with the Lord. And then the second generation now also had trust issues of a sort, but of a different character than with the first generation. The first generation had a major trust issue, and that was with going into the land, going into the promised land. And that was the big one, because there have been major, you know, in-your-face rejections of the creator of heaven and earth that had happened between the time of freedom with that first Passover there, until when they got to the mountain and then going up toward the land. But the worst one was when they go into the land and they said, yes, it is the land that was promised. It is great. It's flowing with milk and honey, as the idiom goes. It is everything that what the Lord described. However, there are already people there, and they're tall, and they've got big walls. So we can't do it. But then when that verdict came back from the Lord saying, okay, well, if you don't think you can do it, then all of this generation is going to have to die off, all the fighting men of this generation, then we'll reboot Israel with the second generation. Maybe they will trust me. So then when that first generation got the verdict saying, okay, you're going to basically now die off here in the desert, they said, no. Okay, we got this. And then they went right up into the land and they got the warning. The Lord passed down through Moshe saying, don't go. Don't go, because the Lord is not going to be with you when you go. You thought you had problems with those tall people and the big walls? Well, try it when the creator of heaven and earth is not there to fight for you. Well, so they went up and they got routed. But the interesting thing was is that, remember when we saw the account back in Numbers, there was only just a few of them that fell as casualties, but they all ran. What did that sound like? We're going to encounter it again when we get to the end of this particular book of Devarim. What is the promise that's given to that second generation when they go into the land? That, what is it? One of you will go, and how many will flee in front of you? 1,000. Well, it was the reverse that happened to them with that rebellious generation. They went in and they were sent to flee when there was just a little bit of casualties on their end. So, thus you've got the reverse and say, well, if you don't take the creator of heaven and earth with you on this endeavor, you will truly be doing it yourself. And then you will truly be that nation that was the original assessment when the Lord called the people, called Abraham's family and said, I didn't pick you because you were the greatest of nations or you were numerous and whatnot. No, I picked you because you were the people of trust. And that was the initial trust of Abraham. Abraham believed, he trusted the Lord, and it was reckoned to him, credited to him as righteousness. He was deemed to be a right walker in the eyes of heaven, walking on the right path. So when we look at Israel's kind of roller coaster history, each of us really have to then ask that question, you know, are we or were we actually in a house of bondage? Are we still there? Have we been freed? Or are we still just milling about? You know, the gates of our own spiritual prison are open, but we won't leave. We just love the chains. Yeah, we just want to stay here. We don't want to go. We don't want to leave. Or if we do go, we keep pining for those shackles to be put back on us. We are so happy about the days when we were just in bondage to our previous lives or what they were. We're not actually being transformed whatsoever into being different people. So if we do acknowledge that we are either still in the prison cell that we were in before, or the door is open, or that we've left and it's now in the past, well, who freed us from that? Who freed us from that? Yes. So thus, we got that in mind. Who was the one who freed us? Did we will it and it happened, or no? So just like with the entering into the promised land, we have to remember who it was who actually freed us. So then, okay, we were freed. We're no longer in the house of bondage anymore. But are we still free, or do we still act like we are still in chains, are still captive to the things that held us before? Yeah, so thus when we talk about that, and you see the Apostle Paul mentions that to when one of his letters to Corinth, and he talks about various undesirable types of people. And he says, like some of you were like this. Some of you were like this, but what? You were changed. You were washed clean. So you are no longer those people anymore. Yes, praise God indeed. Yeah, yes, Yochanan has a comment or a question over there.
Yeah, I heard Rose say we're still in this flesh. Did not Paul say, you know, the good that I would do, I do not do, and the, you know, who's going to deliver me from this body of death?
Yeah.
So apparently there's still things that we do, even though we try not to. But the goal is that even though we're still trying not to, the goal is we're moving in this direction, even though we may take a couple step back.
That's right. So do you live like someone who's actually freed, or do you still have the captive mentality of it? There's nothing I can do, I'm just trapped. Nope, there's nothing I can do about it. So, and one of the things that we always do is we come around in the Torah cycles and we come around in the annual appointments is to always take stock. Where are we in our own journeys? Are we still milling around our prison cell, or have we left? And do we see how much distance has gone between where we were and where we are now? Not to pat ourselves on the back, but remember what? Remember who took us out, and remember who took us to where we're at. Yes, Yochanan has a comment or a question.
For me, these days, is just every Shabbat, every week, of course, every holy day that comes around, the audit is like, how's my armor holding up?
Yep, that's right.
You know, is my sword sharpened? Is my helmet on right? You know, how am I handling the attacks? You know, am I caving into them?
Right.
Am I, you know, laying down and just accepting it? Or am I fighting the good fight of faith?
Yeah, you know, indeed.
You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, indeed. You know, to when you're always going out for an engagement, make sure that you kit up properly. One of the it's kind of the sad things was a testimony of, you know, probably have seen the book, and they made a loosely based on history story of the Ranger units along with the Special Forces Delta unit that was dropped into Mogadishu during some of those battles there. And one of the issues that the Ranger unit went in was they thought this was a quick snatch and grab of a warlord. So what? They didn't take their armor plate with them. They left their armor plate behind. They think, oh, this is, I don't need this. Well, it turned into a very, very long and very, very bad firefight. And there were some wounded that didn't need to be wounded because they, what, left their armor plate behind. So just like you're saying, when you head on into an engagement, make sure that you're properly kitted up to for the engagement you're going into. And don't underestimate the enemy, indeed. Deborah, go ahead.
I just want to, I don't know if it's a comment. Yeah, now the years of practicing reading the Bible has really, really helped because, you know, I have the enemy using my son's mouth and a couple of other people. But, you know, having that word, you know, at first I start feeling really bad, like, oh my God, what a horrible mother, you know, and then I begin to say, you know, he takes that card out at will at the age of 40. And I tell myself, you know, I did the best I could. I mean, what are you going to just get in there and grab it out each time? So, you know, the attacks, but thank God that word helps disarm those thoughts, because if you know you're changing, you know you're trying, you can't disarm every situation, the car, the employee, the boss, the grocer, but you can sure take yourself off in the corner and have a talk and say, you know what, Lord, I'm sorry, I did not act appropriately, you know. And we were listening to someone teaching today, and he says, you know, you make people feel good, you go around treating people really good, you treat them good, you smile at them when you go to the store, you know, so that we can show the love of God. You know, that's what we do in these casualties, in these times of, we're in a war, right? We're in a war with everyone, you know, and it comes at will. So that word, oh God, thank God I could read the Bible.
So one of the things that we'd seen here with the issue is trust. Who are you going to trust? And the word that's under the hood is what word, Christine? Yes. And another great word that goes along with that is emunah. Emunah. And what is what's the root verb that comes from emunah is aman, which is where we get amen from. So when we say amen, that is about let it be done, or to make it so is another way to say that. So that's when we are saying amen, we are saying make it so, let it be done. So that's the question that when you saw that Moshe was recounting this back to this second generation getting ready to go into the land, the question is, are we saying to the Lord, let it be done? If you want us to head into a land, let it be done. For that generation that was headed into the land, were they ready to say, yeah, the people are tall and the walls are high, but let it be done. Let it be done as you have said. So when we look at what was being faced in this particular time period, in the entry that was going into the land, this is the modern day countries that are there surrounding the land. So when you see where they're going in through, this entry point was coming in through modern day Jordan, you know, coming in through modern day Jordan, and then coming up and crossing over the Jordan River, flows up from, you know, it says Kinneret or the Sea of Galilee, and it flows south into the Dead Sea. So crossing over and heading from modern day Jordan and going over into the Holy Land is quite a challenge. So kind of to give you another picture of the challenge as we're seeing it go forward, is well, what was the particular route? And this is kind of a busy map, but it shows you the various ideas that people have had over the years and the centuries and of what route did Israel take getting from Goshen and Mitzrayim, modern-day Egypt, into the Promised Land. And where we have the modern-day, they call it the Sinai Peninsula. The Sinai Peninsula, called so because that's thought to be the traditional site, and you have the traditional sites of Sinai down near the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, which where you have the Yom Suf, Red Sea, and the various arms of it. One goes up towards the modern-day Suez Canal, which goes up then into the Mediterranean Sea, and the other one goes up what's known in modern times as the Gulf of Aqaba, and it separates the Sinai, what's called the Sinai Peninsula, the you call the eastern border of modern-day Egypt now, is separated by this body of water, and on the other side of it is modern-day Saudi Arabia, is on the other side of it. Or, in times before, Midian. And when you see also that when you go north of Midian on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba, modern-day Saudi Arabia, you get into modern-day Jordan. And then you get into Edom, and then north of that, Moab, and then Ammon is before it, which is where Ammon, Jordan today, that's where it gets its name from, is the Ammonites. That's the same root word of where that comes from. So, so, and you see some of the other, go back to another great map. Let's see here. Let's see, another great map that shows also of where the tribes are going into. Yes, here we go. This one will show it. So, and let's see if I can zoom in a little bit more in there. Up, oh, try zooming in a little bit more. There we go. So, this shows in some of the overlap of the people groups that were there in the Holy Land down around that time period where they were coming into the land. So, Edom, these are generalized ideas. So if you just take modern-day Dead Sea and go straight south down this ravine as it goes down toward modern-day Eilat, which is right on the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, modern-day Israel, there's the port of Eilat. And so what is on the east side of that rift valley that goes down from the Sea of Galilee down through the Dead Sea and all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. On the east side of that, that's modern-day Jordan. And the west side is a combination of modern-day Egypt. And then you'll see it roughly then follows the same as kind of brook down here of where modern-day Israel shows up into. So Edom and that area kind of bridged into what is now called the Negev area, southern Israel, and then also a portion of modern-day Jordan. And Moab, just north of that, on the eastern bank, part of the eastern bank of the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it's called here in the Bible. And then you got north of that, some of the other tribes, and Ammon is right above that. So when you see, and it talks about how these people, as they left the mountain, came up and they knocked on the door of Edom, and then they knocked on the door of Moab, and so they had to kind of travel and skirt the other outer edges of it. So they're out there kind of roaming around in modern-day Jordan to then come in toward the Dead Sea area, and actually north of the Dead Sea to where you're starting to make this crossing over into starting to take the land. So thus the kingdoms of Og and Sihon, they're north of Moab. So right north of Moab, then you've got the areas, that's where you then see later on those become the, it talks about the half-tribes. Let's see, yes, the half-tribes of of Manasseh. So you got the half tribe of Manasseh, and then you got Reuben also on the eastern side. So that gives you just a bit of a picture of where the people are coming in. And when they talk about going into the land, there was a number of people who were already there. It mentions in this little recounting of some of the peoples who were there in the land. And they talk about those of Kaftor, etc. Yes, Rose.
When you look at the size of Israel, and then you look at the countries around about Israel, how in the world could you ever imagine that God is not involved in this? I mean, that's just a small country compared to all the countries around them. And you know, all those countries around them still want that little piece.
Well, it's been that way.
But there is a God, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's been that way for ever since you have recorded time in the early parts of the Bible, because earlier on in history, and you see some of that is mentioned in the Bible, is Paro, the kingdoms of Egypt, fought with the sons of Het up here, otherwise known as the Hittite Empire. Where did they fight all the time? It's right in what we call the Promised Land area, that they fought back and forth and back and forth and back and forth over this particular territory. Why? It was a great hub for getting in trade routes going here and there and the other. Because, you know, right north of this, modern-day Lebanon, was what? You hear about Phoenicia, the Phoenician groups. We think of it as a small little group of people. But the thing is that they were like the Dutch of modern times. The Dutch for the past 500 years have been like an unbelievable maritime empire, not because of their great navy, but because of their trade. Phoenicia was like that too. Phoenicia, just sitting up here to the north of the Promised Land, was like that too. They had Phoenician outposts all over the place, like Carthage is thought to have originally been part of that as well. So around the whole Mediterranean, there was all these Phoenician outposts. So when you're talking about the land and going into the land, there was a lot of people who wanted to be there. And as we just saw in our passage here today, there was a lot of people who had been there before, and that the people who were there by the time the Israel was coming back up out of Egypt and out of captivity and out of the 40 years of being out in the desert, it had gone back and forth and changed hands multiple times before that as well. So the question is, well, who do you trust? These various empires trusted on their might to hold on to the territory for the periods of time. And thus, you know, the big walls and the tall people and such. Well, when you trust in those big walls and such, how far does that get you? It gets you only as far as your army is able to have the bigger stick, so to speak. When someone else has a bigger stick, well, guess what? Yeah, you're toast. And you see that later on in the recorded history of Israel, is where they started trying to make favor with a later pharaoh of Egypt, in the time that the Babylonian Empire was rising and the Assyrian Empire was rising. They tried to make deals with Egypt because Egypt was still a superpower of the time period. Well, the issue was is that, yes, Pharaoh had chariots, which were the modern day or the tanks of that day and age. Well, the challenge was is that it didn't matter how many chariots that Paro had. If they didn't go to Israel's defense, what good were they? And if they did go, well, they may be overcome by the forces of Assyria and Babylon. So thus, who it is are you going to trust? Which gets us to a passage that's very interestingly in its corollary to what we're taking a look at here today. And we mentioned this as we were going through a couple of passages. We mentioned this as we were going through Leviticus 16 and talking about the Day of Atonement, which is coming up here in our calendar here in just over a month from now. Imagine that we're backed around to the Day of Atonement again. But we mention this passage a lot because it has a lot to do with faith and trust. Who is it that you trust? And one of the things that is talked about in chapter 4 of Hebrews, so Hebrews chapter 4, it talks about, enter my rest. And you see several quotations in Hebrews chapter 3 where it's quoting from Psalm 95. And it says, I swore in my wrath, you would not enter my rest. And that all refers back to the same situation that Moshe was recounting in the first three chapters of Deuteronomy, and that we had seen previously when we were going through Numbers. And we saw also when we were in a, you could say, a mini rejection and mini treason event back in Exodus chapter 17. As to, yeah, and then you see the golden calf. But in particular, in Exodus 17, that was just right after the Lord delivered Israel out of the house of bondage through the sea, took out the great chariots of Pharaoh, took out those, in, you know, disabled them. The chariots were a disadvantage to Pharaoh when the power of the Lord was actually at play here. Right after that situation, you see the people have no water. And you're in a desert, and you're removing lots of people in a desert, and you don't have a good water supply. How long are you going to last? Not long. You know, yeah, 3 days at most, and you're toast. Yeah, we think about Yom Kippur time and the discipline that we have of just 24 hours without drinking. How do you feel like after 24 hours? Very thirsty. How about 3 days? Yeah. You're on the edge of death, literally. So, thus, when you're seeing that the Lord takes them out, delivers them, and then they have no water, what are they going to do? And what do they ask? Is the Lord with us or not? And that is a refrain that shows up again when they get to the border of the promised land. Is the Lord with us or not? So thus, when we see the lesson that we have of trust in the Lord, that's something that we should not take for granted, as it's something that God gives you trust. Yes, He can give you the sliver of the beginning parts of your belief and trust. But what did the Apostle Yaakov tell us about that? Who also has belief in the existence of the Creator of heaven and earth?
Demons.
Yeah, demons, the powers of the adversary also. Oh, they know full well. Believe me, they know the existence of the power of God very, very well. Yeah, and they shudder. But do they then put what along with it? Do they act on that trust? Well, they can trust fully well that the Lord exists and He has power, ultimate power. But do they act out as if they trust like that? No, they don't. And so thus, that's one of the things that we're talking about in trusting. Something that when the people were delivered out of the house of bondage, they had to, okay, the Lord did these things. He crippled the superpower of the time period with sign after sign after sign after sign. Crush, 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 crush. The plagues. Sign after sign after sign. And what were they signs of? His power and dominion over the so-called pantheon of Mitzrayim, showing that they were powerless to do anything about it. So you could see that the court of Pharaoh was saying, hey, we're ruined. If you don't act to let them go, we're ruined as a country. So thus, the people who are being delivered out, okay, we cried out for deliverance. The Lord heard us, delivered us out. We're moving away from those who once enslaved us. Well, then what? Do we then continue to act like the one who delivered us out? You know, we all get there as being children of our parents. Yeah, we know our parents exist, but do we act? Eventually, hopefully, we come to learn where the source of our help has come from. I mean, obviously, there are family relationships where things go wrong and go badly, but in the best case scenario, you are being delivered from infancy up through being released out as an adult by your parents. Now, we go through that tough period, we call it the teenage years or whatever, where we think, oh, I can now run the show. And we see kind of a mini sort of thing like we encountered with Korach back in Numbers. I can be leader. Why is this guy the leader? And to varying degrees, we can encounter this as children with our parents. You know, who made you the leader of me? I can do it. I'm developing and I'm growing. I'm getting older. I'm wise. It's that old adage about you never realize how smart your parents are until what? You get to be older, yes, and realize. You become a parent. You think you're so smart, then you wonder how they got so smart after you get older. Well, that's one of those things that comes with wisdom, and wisdom is about what? Being able to see the world how it truly is. And that's one of the things that the Lord gives us. Because what is the beginning of knowledge that the Bible tells us? The fear of the Lord and the Yirah of the Lord, that basically, it's interesting how ancient commentators riffed on that word of Yirah, because why? It is what we get the Hebrew word for fear from, but it is also a form of the verb to see. So basically, there is the riff on it is that part of our reverence of the Lord is that the Lord sees us no matter where we are. And we see the prophets riff on this as well, because you'll see later on the prophets will recount that, hey, these people are going off on their own because they say what? The Lord does not see us. He doesn't see what we're doing at all. So we'll just go off and do our own thing. Well, no, the Lord does see who we are. So, if the Lord does see what we're actually doing and who we are, I guess we got some choices then at some point. We can just say, well, great, you see me, I don't care. Or you can say, well, if the Lord does see me and see what I'm doing, now then what? If he can see me, can he see other situations as well? So, if the Lord can see us and who we truly are, see everything about us, as the psalm says, then if he can see other things, can we trust that guidance, that seeing le'olam va'ed, to see into the end and beyond? Can we trust that? Yes, we can trust that. To infinity and beyond. Yes. Yes, Christine, go ahead, please.
I tend to confess here. So forgive me for being confessorially, but there are times that I even am moving into a known sin, or my flesh wants to do something, and I just ask God, could you just conceal your face from me right now, right? Like, or can you conceal me? And I hope I'm not the only one in this room that does that, but sometimes I wish I could just conceal as I, you know, ponder something. And I guess that's the good news, is that we know he sees, we trust that he sees, and therefore, even when we're about to do something against his will, asking for mercy, could you just close your eyes and ears? And he's just like, could you just not do that, please?
Yeah. That is one of the cases that we have of the trust that we have in the Lord, is that the Lord does see. He sees not only us, but he also sees what else is going on around. And as he sees, says, I see the end from the beginning, and then reveals these things through the prophets. So thus, you've got all these witnesses that to not only who we are, what we've done, what we're doing, but also about how everything else works then in the world. Yeah, so as we see in this revelation that we have of in Hebrews 3 and 4, we see the picture of where do you want to go in the land? Do you want to stand at the border of the land, or do you want to cross over into the land? Do you want to just stand there looking across, or do you want to go in? Remember how we finished in some of the last chapters of the book of Numbers, because we just had seen in the recounting that there were some of the tribes, part of Reuben, and then the half-tribe of Manasseh, that they had occupied some of the land that was taken, as we saw in the map, just north of Moab. Well, what was the point of Moshe's hesitance to say, hey, you can settle here on this? Well, if you settle here, what about us as a whole going in and dwelling in the land and to fully occupy the land? Are we in this together as a people or not? Or do we just get our little piece that we are allotted to and just leave everybody else to fend for themselves? So thus, when we see that we have a collection of tribes that will go into the land, and they each selected by lot where each one of them is going to go and the places where they have, but what is it all together? Is it just this whole collection of just independent little fiefdoms? Or is it a people that have the collective cause? It's the people, because it's part of the lesson of being in the wilderness. They were all camped around the presence of where God is. And you're all a part of a whole. You have three tribes, and then three tribes, and then three tribes, and then three tribes on each of the four areas of it. So even though you are separate and you are keeping on your tradition as being a separate tribe, whether it's Benjamin or whatever, all of them are working together as a whole. All of them. You have your independence, and your independence is important. But you also are a very important collective together, because you are working together as a... yes, Christine has a comment or a question over there. You're working together as a collective.
This is also for us as being grafted in, right? So we are our own entity, but we are working for the same community.
Yes.
Right? The same purpose, being a light unto the world, leading in the ways, pointing to Yah, and through the blood of Yeshua coming in from the nations. So even though we are in a different land, we still are connected to the people and the land and the covenant.
So as we go on and take a closer look at this, now, even though there are so many tribes, what in each of the tribes has their own designated area that they're going to occupy in the land? Which tribe does not have a designated area in the land? Levi, yes, Levi. And what is special about, yes. What's special about Levi, yes. What's special about Levi, yes. They got all the work. Okay, what is the Lord is their inheritance, but also a very special person comes from Levi, right?
Yes.
From a special family in Levi, right? Yes, Aharon's family. Then we got the high priest. So, yes, so even though there are all of these tribes, there is one tribe that is spread amongst all of them, and that glues the glue, that glues them all together. So what is the special thing that they are entrusted to do? Not just the family of Aharon, and then one person of the family of Aharon, who is the high priest, the Kohen HaGadol. Not just that person, but what do all the rest of them do of Levi? Service the temple, but also teaching, yes. To take what? The words of God to then take them all out to the nation. They are the teachers of the nation. So then what is the glue that holds the whole nation together? Every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God is the glue. So yes, so thus you have many of these parts, but one whole, and that one whole is held together by the glue of every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So thus you can see where this picture that we have in the book of Hebrews and how it is where the high priest and the ministry of the high priest fits together of this, and where the Day of Atonement comes into play, and where this, you are coming together and entering into the rest of God together. You have to trust the one who is taking you in. It's not your own little fights that you have inside your tribe or this or that or the other. You're all going in to the land of rest. And the one who takes you in, you have a special agent who's coming out of the one who takes you in. So thus, where you see that the picture of chapters 1 through 10 of the book of Hebrews is about, we say we have a great high priest over the house of God. Yes. So thus, really, this whole book, most of the meat of the letter to Hebrews that we have is that who Yeshua is, what the tabernacle is, what the role the high priest plays, and what it means to be without a tabernacle or a temple and the high priest, and why the word tabernacle continues to be open for business when the earthly tabernacle and high priest aren't able to function, which is part of where we were seen with Matthew 24 that we read today. The abomination of desolation. We've talked about this when you get around to Hanukkah time, because one of the things that was prophesied by the prophet Daniel is that there would be this power that would come in and put the temple out of action and set up an abomination of desolation. Yohanan, we have a question or a comment there.
Yeah, I was watching something about from the Temple Institute. You know, everybody's looking for a third temple to be built, but they're saying, you know, we could put a tent out, you know, where they used to put a tent.
Yeah.
You know, so abomination.
You still need the very special thing, which the book of Hebrews also talks about, and that is the red heifer, to put that into action. Problem is that who offers it? Yeah, we talked about this a few months ago when we went through that passage of Numbers 19, where it talks about the red heifer. The thing is who offers it? And there is a large part of debate, because a lot of people say, well, the Bible seems to indicate that you have to have the ashes of a red heifer to put the priesthood into place and to have the special people and to cleanse the contact with death and the contact with the red heifer. So the issue then is that it is a bit of a chicken and the egg situation. Is you need a red heifer to institute and to offer a red heifer. So that is a particular issue. And it's kind of interesting. We were talking about in our Galatians study about the Dead Sea Scrolls, the passage there of the scroll 4QMMT, which is where we get that line that says Maaseh HaTorah, or the works of the law. And that's a passage that the Apostle Paul uses. So that particular passage of where that comes from, that same scroll also talks about the red heifer and the fact of you, because that particular scroll dates to about 150 BC, which should start making some bells go off in your head. What was 150 BC? We just talked about that Hanukkah time, because Hanukkah is talking about a time period of what, 165 or so BC is to where that whole situation was for the 6-year period where it was out of commission. So thus, you have a very interesting situation of having a very critical point of having to make sure that the red heifer ashes are preserved, because why? It's very hard. It's like having some sort of an engine that you have to restart if you don't have fuel for it. If you've ever had to prime an engine back in the days when you could do so before fuel injection, to get an engine started if it's totally out of fuel it can be very challenging. Yes, Christine, go ahead, please.
I just think about even as the morning of the temple is coming up, just about the baseless hatred. We haven't even maybe overcome that, the Lashon Hara, the baseless hatred. And I always think for us as a community and me as an individual is I need to overcome my lawlessness and my own abominations, perhaps, before I'm worrying about how the whole nation is, you know, clean up my house. The log out of my own eye, as well as, you know, just the baseless hatred, which, you know, Yeshua really pointed to in terms of when that second temple would go down, he was hated. Yeah. So that's what comes to mind when I think about the temple erecting and all of that. Yeah. How ready are we? How ready are we as a people? Are we as individuals? That whole thing. Are we really free? Are we acting like we're free? Are we walking in righteousness that's been credited under the merit of Yeshua?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And you're talking about some of the issues related to baseless hatred. But one of the things that we have from the Gospels is a key reason for the abomination of desolation, and a prime precursor to that. And that is when you see Yeshua talking about and quoting there from Psalm 118 about, you will not see me again until you say what? Blessed is he, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So that being a precursor to saying, hey, remember what this house is all about and what the tabernacle is all about, that it is a pattern after something that is happening in heaven, which is what the focus of the whole letter of Hebrews is all about, that this is a picture. These are types and symbols of something, extremely important symbols of something, not mere symbols or something that you can discard if you don't like it. Yeah. They are extremely important because it points us to what is in the beyond. Kind of like what you're talking about with Shabbat. Shabbat, which is something Hebrews chapter 4 talks about, is just like you have Shabbat, which is a time where you say stop, because the Lord tells us, hey, you stop because the Lord stopped the creation and said, hey, everything here I have made is very good. So the Lord blessed it, he hallowed it, he carved it out as a memorial in time that, hey, this is the work of the Creator. Well, then how much more then is the land then a picture of what God does with us when we go from our Egypt, our house of bondage, to our house of freedom? That is a work that the Lord does in freeing us. Hallelujah. All right, well, that is where we will close things out here today. Just want to finish things off with a recap and actually a looking forward over the book of Deuteronomy. I hope you got a chance to grab one of the outlines that we have over there that gives you an overview of the book of Deuteronomy. There's lots of different ways that people have taken the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, and said that there are patterns within it. One of the patterns that you see in much of the book of Deuteronomy relates to parallels with each of the Ten Commandments, and how each of the Ten Commandments as a parallels, because some people think, oh, these are a bunch of like random laws that are just here, there, wherever. But if you line them up to each of the Ten Commandments, you will see that, hey, they are actually help you understand each one of the Ten Commandments and how each one of these Ten Commandments isn't something for a bunch of so-called sun-stroked goat herders wandering around the desert. This is stuff that is applicable even more so in our modern day and era.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.